Hey everybody, this is Dominique. Are you ready to do more with your life and money? Today we'll be answering and tackling some of the most frequently asked financial questions from a website that gets over 30 million views per month. And who knows, maybe some of your burning questions will be included. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss it.
Are you tired of feeling like there's more to life that you're just not experiencing? Are you unmotivated by keeping up with the status quo? Are you ready to start living intentionally with your finances and creating the life you want? Get ready for Experiencing Financial Contentment with Dominique Henderson, a podcast focused on helping you create margin for the life you want to live by putting your money where your heart is. Each week, Dominique will help you explore the decisions you make around money so that you can achieve better results. Now, here's your host, Dominique Henderson.
Hey, everybody. This is Dominique, owner and founder of DJH Capital Management and host of this podcast, Experiencing Financial Contentment, where we're helping you to do more with your life and money around the themes of financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. And so today, for all my repeat listeners, I want to thank you for listening and watching. And for any of you new guys out there, you're about to take the red pill to the matrix of leaving the average and doing more with your life and money and living a life of financial contentment. So I wanted to dive into some of the most frequently asked questions, and we're probably going to split this up to two or three episodes, possibly, depending on how much we can get through and how long it takes me to explain stuff. sometimes I'm good at that, sometimes I'm not. But we'll break it down to frequently asked questions, kind of like the best of what the public wants to know. And then we will do another episode, which will be or subsequent episode with situations. Right. So I, as some of you may know and follow, if you don't, go to Investopedia and follow me on Investopedia. Follow us on social media, as all the stuff below says below. So I work with Investopedia as an advisor, and they have a program called Advisor Insights. I've talked about this before, but basically they get about 30 million unique views a month, I believe, on their website, which is just huge. And so investors like yourself come in and ask questions, and advisors like myself go in and answer those questions and provide, you know, some color around what they're trying to accomplish. You know, sometimes they ask a lot of some deep questions with a lot of detail, and sometimes they don't. So the answers are pretty vague. But anyways, I have obviously a slew of questions and answers that I've provided over the last 2 years of doing this. And so what I thought today would be really cool to do is just kind of go in and give you a behind the scenes on some of those questions. Maybe they're questions that you've wanted to know before, and just kind of walk through some of the scenarios. And so we'll go, like I said, we'll do this over two or three episodes, however long it takes to kind of explain this so that it is helpful for you guys going forward. And that's the whole goal. So I think we'll go ahead and dive in. We're going to use a screen share today because I'll be wanting to write some of this stuff down. So if you give me just a minute, let's go with the first one, and let's just move over here. So the first question I got was about 2 years ago, and full disclosure here, I am not giving financial advice. I'm just going to be walking through some of the questions here. So your situation may differ a little from anybody that I go through. And so any particular advice that I'm giving is just circumstantial, situational. Different situations may apply for you. And so you'll need to sit down with somebody like myself or look at a plan that looks at all your possibilities and all the different scenarios so that you don't get any errant advice, because I don't want to give errant advice. I just want advice. I just want to give some examples of what people are asking and maybe give you a couple of, you know, pointers and color and stuff on that. So, okay, that's my disclaimer out the way. All right, here we go. So this question is, what is a good debt ratio and what is a bad debt ratio? And like I said, I got this 2 years ago. I guess I could have put the questions up there. That would have helped. But anyways, all right. So what is a good debt ratio and what is a bad debt ratio? Okay. So I have heard this term good debt, bad debt before. And I think the best way to do this is just to kind of illustrate it. So let's take this off and let's get the whiteboard up here. Okay. We're using a lot of technology today. I don't think I'm gonna get through all my questions. Okay. Good. All right. So let's just talk about good and bad. All right. As far as debt and what's concerned there. And then at the bottom, what we'll do is we'll have our income. All right. And I'll show you what I'm going to do here. So let's just say good debt. I'm going to say that, first of all, you probably want to move towards debt freedom at some point in your life, because it just frees you up with more margin and options. Okay. But while you're in the accumulation phase of life, is what they call when you're accumulating assets for distribution later on in life, you're going to have things like a house, right? So that could be good debt. That is an asset that normally is going to appreciate. And then you may have to go to school and do student loans. Okay. So those would be the two things that I would say you can warrant financing those things. Now, on the bad debt side, I know we all need them, but cars are depreciating assets unless you're like a Jay Leno and you collect cars. Otherwise, they're depreciating assets, and you definitely don't want to have too much car. That's not the scope of this podcast, but you know, if you're making $50,000 a year, there's no reason why you would have a $25,000 car or something like that. You need to try to find a minimal vehicle and try to pay it off or buy a used vehicle. So car would obviously be there. Credit card would obviously be there. Any type of consumer revolving debt, whether it's, a Macy's card or whatever. Those are going to be bad types of debts. And I'm not going to go through all this, but let's just say that your good debt equaled to, I don't know, on a monthly basis, let's say that this is $1,500 or so. I'm just going to throw out some numbers. And then over here was 500. Okay. And let's just say that you altogether, this is $2,000. Oops. $2,000 of debt payments every month. Now, depending on your income, let's just say you make 10 grand a month. You can see really quickly, this is basically about 20% of your income. And of that, about 15% is good debt, and then 5% is bad debt, if my math is correct. So what you basically want to do is probably keep your bad debt ratio as small as possible. That's what I would give you. There's not really a certified financial planner term for good debt or bad debt or anything. I'll give you a couple of ratios. I know when you go buy anything and start to finance it, an underwriter is going to, you know, basically look for you to have a debt to income ratio of 40% or less, right? So for every dollar you bring in, you should have no more than 40 cents of debt. And so in this case, this person would, because it's only 20%. Okay. So that good debt or bad debt ratio. This was actually a question that was asked and viewed a lot. I guess just because we're in a world where a lot of things have to be financed. And so you really want to make sure that you're not putting yourself in a bind by having a lot of your current lifestyle be borrowed versus paying cash for that. Okay, so let's go to the next question. Just take that off. And all right. Okay, so the next question is, what are unrealized gains and losses? Unrealized gains or losses. So when you buy a stock, let's just use a stock, mutual fund, stock, bond, doesn't matter. Listen, when you buy a stock, you're opening what is called a tax lot. And that's just so basically the IRS can know how much money they need to collect from you when you sell it. it's capital gains tax. So when you open that tax lot, and let's say you open it at, and you buy the stock at 10, okay? Maybe we should get the whiteboard back up. We got it anyway, so let's go ahead and put it back up. it could be helpful. So let's do that this way. All right. That just means that I'm not going to be able to cover as many questions, and we'll have to do a part two. All right. So let's say you purchase the stock. That's what happens when you have technological difficulties here. Let's wait for it to load. All right, there we go. So we purchase, buy at 10, okay? So you own these shares at 10, and an unrealized gain would be defined as the appreciation, which would be the difference. Let's say it's trading now at 12. So this $2 of paper gains is what is called an unrealized gain. All right. Similarly, if it was trading now at 8, the difference between that would be a paper loss of $2. So those are unrealized gains and losses. Now, when you close out this tax lot and finally sell it at 8 or 12 or wherever it's going to be, you will then have what is called a realized gain or loss for that particular investment. Okay. So that's how that works. And I'm having difficulties with my screen and whatnot. So that looks like we won't be doing too much of that. Okay. So let's get the next question going here. Can an individual contribute to both a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA in the same year? The answer is yes, as long as you're under the limit. And for 2018, the limit is $5,500. If you're over 50, you can do a catch up of an extra $1,000 of $6,500. Double check my numbers. I'm pretty sure that's correct, though. So you could, let's kind of break down IRA contributions. Sometimes they can be deductible, which means that you can get a tax write off for contributing. And sometimes they're not. So those are IRAs. And as long as you meet, don't exceed the limit, you can contribute as much as you want whenever you want. You can contribute whenever you want in any given tax year, and you can split that difference between a Roth and a traditional. Now, you have to be income eligible for a Roth, and this is adjusted by inflation every year. And it depends on how you file, whether that be single, head of household, or married following joint. So you'll have to check those. Just go to irs.gov and you can check those numbers. But basically, why would you want to maybe split the difference of your, let's say, $5,500 contribution every year? Well, a Roth is going to allow you to do a couple things. Anything you put in there is already been taxed. So the gains on that won't be taxed again once you take that money out. And you don't have to take it out at 70.5 like you do with the traditional IRA. At 70.5, you have what are called required minimum distributions. And that just means that the money is being forced out whether you need it or not so that you can pay taxes on it. Because usually the money that goes into a traditional IRA is pre-taxed and it grows on a tax deferred basis, right? So you may want to split your contribution between those two type accounts if you're eligible for the Roth, so that you can have some amount of your money that is growing tax-free and some of your amount of money that would be going tax-deferred. In most cases, once you reach, I think it's like, you know, if you're singles, right around 100,000 or married, filing joint around 190-ish or so, you cannot contribute to a Roth. So it may be prohibitive for you to do that. You can always make a traditional IRA contribution and then make a Roth, do a backdoor Roth, which basically means you pay the taxes on that income immediately, and then you can stuff it into a Roth. So hopefully that answers that question, and let's go on to the next one. All right. Do financial advisors get paid by mutual funds? So we'll probably put a needle in it for this one and move on to the other four or so questions we have for the next episode. So we'll finalize everything with this episode, we'll finalize everything with this question. Okay. So let's see. It depends on the type of advisor, and you're going to have to check their fee schedule. So in episode 13, what to look for in a good financial advisor, I kind of walked through my own ADV, which is my brochure that you're required to file as long as you have some type of oversight from either the federal level, like SEC, or state level. You're required to file that if you're a registered investment advisor, like myself. So you can look through there to see how people get compensated. That's probably the easiest way, because sometimes people don't have that on their websites. But let's talk about the three ways that the financial advisors can be compensated, right? So you got fee only, which is myself. So I charge mainly based on advice, and there may be a fee for assets under management. So that's fee only. There are no commissions involved. Then you have guys and gals that are commission only, no fees involved. So commissions come from a company that they represent or that sponsors them in some type of way to represent or to sell their products. And usually there is a commission associated with the sale of that product. The commission, it just depends on the company and what type of product, what type of commission they're going to get. So, you know, that can be with annuities, that can be with life insurance, that could be with mutual funds. And so you just need to make sure that the incentives of the person selling you the product and giving you the financial advice is aligned with yours. There's nothing wrong, and I'll say this very clearly, there is nothing wrong with commissions. I, as a person, have decided not to accept commissions just because that's what I choose to do. But there's plenty of my colleagues, guys and gals, that do a good job of being financial advisors, and they accept commissions. Your job as a consumer of financial services is to make sure that the person giving you advice is giving you objective advice, not influenced by the amount of money they're going to make by the commission that they receive from whoever the product is coming from. Okay. So you just need to check the conflicts of interest, and you can ask them a bunch of questions. I've talked about this in previous podcast episodes about the questions to ask a financial advisor. So go back and review that. And then there can be people that do both, right? So commission and fees together, you know, they may sell some life insurance along with, you know, different things like that. So let's get back to the question, which is, do financial advisors get paid by mutual funds? And so indirectly, yes, right? And so you got to kind of watch how this works. So let's say that you have a mutual fund, and you have a fund that is a load fund, right? So you have no load funds and you have load funds. No load funds, obviously you can't get paid by that because there's no loads. Loads are just the fees associated, advertising fees or marketing fees, basically, that are associated with the mutual fund company that they compensate financial advisors with to sell their mutual fund. That's how that works. So this is not as popular as it was, let's say, 10 years ago, because there are so many no load funds, and there's ETFs and there are index funds that don't have all this structure. But the let's say the somewhat Byzantine and archaic structure of mutual funds back in the past were three different types of shares, right? So you had A shares, B shares, and C shares. And what typically happened is the A shares would charge you an upfront load, right? So let's say for every $100 that you are investing with an A share, 5% came right off the top. So you were really investing only 95% going into that investment. And then that 5% was going to do a lot of stuff for the mutual fund company. But one of those things was to compensate the advisor who sold you that fund. B shares have a back end sales charge that is usually, like, you know, it declines over time, depending on how long you hold the fund. You actually are able to convert to A shares from B shares. And then those typically have some type of ongoing maintenance fees or whatnot. And then you have Class C shares, which, you know, that the back end fee basically expires after a certain amount of time, and you don't have to worry about that. So, mutual fund compensation to financial advisors, yes, it just depends. So you just have to kind of look at these type of things. And so let's go back to the question beneath the question, because I always like to kind of do that, and we'll wrap it up. But what you want to establish when you're sitting down with a financial advisor and somebody that's supposed to give you objective advice in regards to the financial goals that you want to reach and achieve, what you need to do is you need to explore what are called conflicts of interest. Can this person give you competent advice? Okay, check that box. Yes, they can. Are they incented to give you advice set of advice A versus set of advice B based on the way they're compensated? That's the question you need to ask them. And that's fine for you to ask them that question on the phone or across the table or however you meet with them, because they need to be able to give you a really good definitive answer on how they manage their conflicts of interest if they are compensated on a commission type basis, right? So this is one of the reasons why I personally, as a financial advisor, having been a student in the market for a very long time, have decided just from an ethical and moral standpoint to eliminate that whole conflict. I don't have to talk to you about how I manage it, because I don't have to manage it, because it doesn't exist with me. So some people have decided to go that route because it just makes things really simple. And some people have decided not to. So it's up to your own personal preference around who you want to work with. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll get into another set of questions similar to the format in this podcast. After we do that, we're going to go through some scenarios, because I actually have some scenarios that have come into me through the same channel. Situational things where people are saying, hey, this is going on, what do you think I should do? And maybe some of that stuff will apply to you. So that's what this is all about. Want to help you do better. If you want to continue this and you want to ask me some questions personally, a good chance to do that, or a good way to do that, would be through the Facebook group, right? So if you are not in the Facebook group, which is Experiencing Financial Contentment, creating Experiencing Financial Contentment is the name of this podcast. Creating Your Roadmap to Financial Contentment is the Facebook group that I'm in there answering questions on the podcast about the podcast. It's kind of an addendum to the podcast, and we talk about personal development, economic empowerment, and financial literacy, the same themes of the podcast. So it's a good way to jump in there and ask me some questions off the cuff and stuff that you don't want to necessarily you just might want to have insight on it, whatever. Get a second opinion from a professional that cares about you and cares about you winning with your money. So that's a good way to do that. And I thank you for listening. I thank you for watching. We will see you later. Take care. Bye-bye.